carried out under the guise of a group of rebels called the Northern Alliance, were already underway. 20 minutes later, I saw news reports of explosions in the Afghan capital of Kabul, and I knew that the so-called War on Terror had begun. Claustrophobic, depressed, I went for a walk. The War on Terror sounded about as generic as the War on Drugs, and I knew from personal experience how successful that had been. The streets of Geneva were deserted, the bars silent, the electric trams empty. I heard later it was the same in cities from Sydney to London, as if for a time the lights had dimmed in the Western world in sympathy with America. I made my way through what are called the English Gardens, skirted the clutch of Moroccan drug dealers lamenting among themselves the lack of business, thought for a moment of putting a bullet through them just for the hell of it, and walked along the lakeside promenade. Straight ahead lay the exclusive village of Koloni, where Fahd, the ruler of Saudi Arabia, the Aga Khan, and half the crooks of the world had their homes. I sat on a bench at the edge of the lake and looked across the water at the United Nations on the other side. Brilliantly floodlit, totally useless. Below it, almost on the lake's edge, rose the gray bulk of the President Wilson Hotel, commanding a perfect view of Lake Geneva's most popular beach. Every summer, Saudis and other rich Arabs would pay a huge premium for rooms at the front so that they could watch women sunbathing topless on the grass. With well-stocked minibars, it was like an Arab version of an upmarket strip club, without the inconvenience of tipping. Although it was late, the lights were on in most of the rooms now. I guess they had realized what sort of shit was about to come down and were packing their binoculars and bags, getting ready for the first flight home. But no matter what Western revenge would be exacted on Osama bin Laden and Arabs in general, one thing was certain. The events of the last 12 hours were an intelligence failure of historic proportions. The overriding mission of the hugely expensive United States intelligence community was to protect the homeland, and not since Pearl Harbor had these all-powerful organizations screwed up with such spectacular and public results. As I sat in the cool Geneva night, I wasn't pointing the finger at others. None of us was without blame. We all carried the blue badges. We all bore the responsibility. But so did the president and congressmen whom we served, those who established our budgets and priorities. Unlike us, at least they could speak out publicly, but I figured it would be a long wait before the American people got an apology from any of them. The next millennium, maybe. The wind was rising, sweeping out of the Alps and bringing with it the smell of rain. It was a long walk back to my hotel, and I should have started then, but I didn't move. I was certain, even if nobody else was thinking it yet, that pretty soon Lower Manhattan wouldn't be the only thing in ruins. The nation's entire intelligence structure would be torn apart. It had to be, if it was going to be rebuilt. Nothing in the secret world would ever be the same again, not least for the division. People in government would no longer have any interest in secretly policing the covert world. They would only be interested in secretly policing the Islamic world. I had got up in the morning, and by the time I was ready for bed, it was a different planet. The world doesn't change in front of your eyes. It changes behind your back. I knew I had none of the language or operational skills necessary for the brave new intelligence world which was about to be born. So I found myself, like Marcus Boucher, suddenly at a fork in the road, unsure what future lay ahead of me, not necessarily seeking happiness, but fulfillment wouldn't be bad. I was lost. I had to ask myself what life I really wanted. Sitting alone with the storm rolling towards me, I looked back over the years and found, if not an answer, at least a way forward. Rising out of the past to meet me was a remote village called Kunyam, just on the Thai side of the Burma border. Looking back, I think the memory of it had waited for years in darkness, knowing its time would come. It is wild, lawless country up there, not far from the Golden Triangle, and when I was first starting out in this business, I had only been in Berlin for a month, I found myself washed up on its shore. Nothing distinguished Kunyam from the other hill tribe villages, except that 5 clicks out in the jungle stood a series of grim cinder-block buildings surrounded by guard towers and an electric fence. Officially a relay post for the global positioning system, it was in fact a CIA black prison, part of a vehemently denied but real American gulag. Remote facilities used to house prisoners who couldn't be legally tortured back home. One of the guards had died in-house, and while the Tokyo office normally would have handled it, they were so overwhelmed by yet another Chinese spy scandal that I found myself leaving Europe and flying into a place called Mei Hong Sun, the City of Three Mists, on an old turboprop. Most of the time it was a short chopper ride out to the GPS station, but this was the monsoon season, and they didn't call it the City of Three Mists for nothing. I rented a Toyota four-wheel drive from a guy who I guessed was a local opium baron, and headed for Kunyam and its CIA prison. Passing through spectacular mountains, I came to an ancient cable ferry. It was the only way to cross a roaring river, swollen by the monsoon, a tributary of the mighty Mekong, the scene of so many secret operations and so much U.S. misery during the Vietnam War. I got out of the car, gaunt and hollow-eyed. I had been traveling non-stop for 32 hours, fueled by nothing more than ambition and anxiety about the mission. As I waited among a clutch of food vendors and villagers, watching a rusty cable drag the flat-bottomed ferry towards us in plumes of spray, a Buddhist monk in saffron robes asked if I wanted a cup of masala chai, the local tea. He spoke good English, and with nothing else on offer except the deadly Thai elephant beer, I gratefully accepted. The monk was heading upcountry too, and given I was supposed to be a WHO expert surveying endemic diseases, it was pretty hard to refuse his request for a ride. We crossed the river in the Toyota, the barge plunging and barely afloat, water blasting over the gunwales and 2 inches of rusted cable, the only thing between us and one of the country's highest waterfalls, half a click downstream. The worst white-knuckle ride of my life. As we drove out of the gorge, the jungle forming a canopy over our heads, the monk looked at me a little too long and asked about my work. Thanks to my medical training, I gave an excellent account of breakbone fever, but it soon became clear he didn't believe a word of what I was saying. Maybe he knew about the cinderblock camp at Kunyam. He had lived at an ashram not far from New York, so he had more knowledge than you would expect about American life, and he spoke intelligently about recreational drugs and the pressures of modern life. I started to get the feeling it wasn't a casual conversation. "You look hunted," he said finally, in that Buddhist way, more in sorrow than in judgment. "Hunted?" I laughed and told him it was the first time I had ever heard that. People usually put me on the other side of the food chain.
"There is no other side of the food chain," he said quietly. "Only the West believes that. Without grace, everyone is running from something."
Our eyes met. Smiling, I asked if he'd ever considered pursuing a religious life. He laughed right back and wanted to know if I had heard how villagers caught monkeys. I told him I knew a few things about life, but that wasn't one of them. We didn't eat much monkey at Harvard, generally only at Thanksgiving and Christmas, I said. So he told me how the villagers chain a ewer, a vase with a narrow neck and a bulbous bottom, to the base of a tree.
"They fill the bottom with nuts and whatever else monkeys like to eat. In the night, a monkey climbs out of the trees and slips his hand down the long neck. He grabs the sweets, and his hand makes a fist. That means it's too big to get back up the narrow neck, and he's trapped. In the morning, the villagers come round and hit him on the head."
He looked at me for a moment.
"It's a Zen story, of course," he said, smiling again. "The point is, if you want to be free, all you have to do is let go."
Yes, I understood that much, I told him. It was a good story, but it didn't mean anything to me. Not now, anyway.
"I suppose not," he replied. "But perhaps I was put on the road to tell it to you. You're young, Doctor. Maybe the time will come when it will mean something.
And he was right, of course. The time did come, and in a different way from anything I could have imagined. It was sitting in the Geneva night, waiting for a storm, thinking about mass murder in New York, and women in short skirts recruiting even brighter young graduates for a new era. I was 31 years old, and I realized, through no fault of my own, I had been trained for tank warfare in Europe, only to find the battle was with guerrillas in Afghanistan. Like it or not, history had passed me by. On another level, far deeper, I knew that sooner or later I wanted to find something. Something it's hard for me to put a name to. A thing most people call love, I suppose. I wanted to walk along a beach with someone and not think about how far a sniper rifle can fire. I wanted to forget that you feel the bullet long before you hear the shot. I wanted to find somebody who could tell me what safe harbor really meant. I knew with all my heart that if I didn't leave the secret world now, I never would. To turn your back on everything you know is hard, among the most difficult things you'll ever do, but I kept telling myself one thing. If you want to be free, all you have to do is let go. Chapter 14. I wrote out my resignation late that night in the Hotel du Rhône, dispatched it by diplomatic courier the next morning, and immediately flew to London. I spent the next 3 weeks wrapping up my outstanding cases and giving the files to the FBI. In the first of many huge changes to the U.S. intelligence community, the division had been closed down, and its responsibilities assumed, after 4 decades of trying, by the feds. Ironically, my last day on the job was in Berlin, the city where everything had really started for me. I locked the office for the final time and accompanied the staff out to Tempelhof for the flight home. I shook hands with them and, an agent to the end, said I was booked on a later plane. Instead, I walked out of the front doors and, carrying a totally new identity, got a taxi to a car dealership, where I took delivery of a Cayenne Turbo. With 500 horsepower, I figured I was more or less ready for the Autobahn. I threw my bags in the back, was past Frankfurt by evening, and crossed the border in the early hours of the morning. Fall had come late that year, and even by moonlight I don't think I had ever seen the French countryside looking more beautiful. I flew past villages with romantic names and found the Péage, a tollway, I was looking for. If you come into Paris from the south, there's a remarkable point between the towering high-rises in which the French warehouse their immigrants, where the first sight of the city is almost completely hidden from you. The only thing you see is the Eiffel Tower standing on the horizon. It was early in the morning, a chill in the air lending a sparkling clarity to everything. I had seen the view many times before, but even so it took my breath away. The sense of release that had been growing in me through the night finally broke its banks, and I pulled to the side of the road. To be in Paris when you're young and free, well, there's not much on earth better than that. I rented an apartment in the part of the 8th arrondissement Parisians call the Golden Triangle, just off the beautiful Rue François Première. Day after day, and late into the night, I wrote the book that few people would read. Except for one young woman in New York, I would desperately wish hadn't. After 6 months it was done. Hundreds of thousands of words, all annotated and checked. I felt the washing out of my earlier life was complete. I had written the final chapter on that era and sent it downstream like a funeral barge into the past. I was proud of the book. Call it a public service, call it naive if you want, but I thought if my expertise could help defeat just one man like Christos Nikolaidis, then it was a candle worth the burning. After careful vetting by a team of analysts working for the Director of Intelligence, the book was published by a small house that specialized in harrowing memoirs about escapes from Castro's Cuba and female honor killings among Arabs. In other words, it was a secret subsidiary of the CIA. Such a publisher was obviously accustomed to authors whose identities had to be concealed, but even so, my case was complicated. When I gave up my badge, it was decided I knew enough about national security that nobody could ever know who I was or what job I had done. Without meaning to, the secret world took my identity and my history from me. When the book finally appeared, not only was Jude Garrett given as the author's name, but an entire identity had been created for him. Anybody who made inquiries received the following biography. Jude Garrett, a graduate of the University of Michigan, spent over 14 years in law enforcement, first with the Sheriff's Department in Miami, and then as a special investigator with the FBI. He died while on assignment in Chicago. The manuscript of this book, which he had researched extensively, was found in his study shortly after his death, and represents the last testament of one of the world's finest investigators. And it was true. Some of it, anyway. There had been an FBI agent called Jude Garrett, and he was dead, a car wreck on his way home from work. Unmarried, a loner with few interests outside work, the publisher simply appropriated his identity and gave him a literary accomplishment in death he had never found in life. I have to admit, I liked his biography, and I liked the fact he was dead. I mean, who would go looking for a dead man? Well, somebody did. With the book finally published, the funeral barge almost lost to view, I had started for the first time in my adult life to live in a world without secrets. I looked at all the laughing women, hips swinging, sashaying down the wide boulevards of Paris, and as spring became summer, I started to believe anything was possible. The problem with the spy business, though, is that while you can resign, you can never leave. I suppose I didn't want to acknowledge it then, but too much wreckage floats in the wake of a life like mine. People you've hurt don't forget. And at the back of your mind is the one lesson they drummed into you when you were young and your whole career was ahead of you. In this business, you can't learn by your mistakes. You don't get a chance. Make one, and you're dead. The only thing that will save you is your intuition and your tradecraft. Burn them into your soul. I suppose I must have listened because, still only 9 months into my retirement, I noted a cab with a passenger circling the block. Nobody does that in Paris. Given the chaotic traffic, it could take hours. It was just after 8, a busy Friday night, and I was at a sidewalk cafe on the Place de la Madeleine, waiting for an aging doctor. He was a gourmand whose young Russian dates usually cost more for the night than the dinners he lavished on them, so he was always short of cash. To my mind, genteel poverty was a great advantage in a medical practitioner. It meant that when he was giving a diagnosis and writing a prescription, he was prepared to listen to a patient's own suggestions, if you catch my drift. I didn't mark the white taxi the first time it passed, not consciously anyway, but somewhere in all my tradecraft, the ever-changing tangle of traffic must have been registering. The second time it went by, I knew it had been there before. Heart spiking hard, I didn't react. That was the training kicking in. I just let my eyes follow it as casually as I could, cursing that a combination of headlights and traffic prevented me from seeing clearly who was in the back. It didn't matter, I suppose. I just think it's nice to know the identity of the people who've come to kill you. The tide of vehicles carried the taxi away, and I knew I didn't have long. The first pass, they locate you. The second, they plan the angles. The third, they fire. I dropped 10 euro on the table and moved fast onto the sidewalk. I heard a voice behind, yelling. It was the doctor, but I didn't have time to tell him we couldn't help feed each other's habits tonight. I jagged left into Hadyard, the city's best food store, and moved quickly past pyramids of perfect fruit and into the crowded wine section. Everything was unfolding in a rush, like it always does in such situations, and while I didn't have any evidence, my instinct was screaming that it was the Greeks. The old man not only had the financial clout, but also the deep emotional motive to search for revenge. The sort of incentive every missed Christmas and birthday would only have made stronger. He also had easy access to the personnel. Crime intelligence reports from any police force in Europe would tell you that half of Albania was involved in the murder-for-hire business. From Hadyard's wine department, a door accessed a side street, and I went through it without pause, turning left. It was a one-way street, and I walked fast towards the oncoming traffic, the only strategy in the circumstances. At least you can see the shooter coming. Scanning the road ahead, I realized I was acting to a well-organized plan. I didn't know it until then, but wherever I went, part of me was always thinking about the best way out, an unseen escape program constantly running in the background of my mind. My biggest regret was about my gun. A cup of coffee, a quick meeting with the doctor, and a cab home, half an hour maximum, I had figured. That meant the gun was in a safe back at the apartment. I had grown sloppy, I guess. Even if I saw them coming, there was little I could do now. Home was exactly where I was heading. First thing, to open the damn safe and get myself weaponed up. I turned right, walked fast for a block, turned left, and met the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré, exactly where I wanted. Just down the road from the Élysée Palace. Whichever Greek or Albanian was in the taxi would know it was the safest street in Paris. Snipers on the rooftops, the whole length under constant anti-terrorist surveillance. Only now did I feel comfortable enough to grab a cab. I got the driver to stop hard against my building's service entrance. By cracking open the door of the cab and staying low, I could unlock the steel door and get inside without anybody seeing me. The driver thought I was crazy, but then his religion thinks stoning a woman to death for adultery is reasonable, so I figured we were about even. Slamming the door behind me, I ran through the underground garages. The limestone building had once been a magnificent townhouse, built in the 1840s by the Comte de Crissier, but had fallen into ruin. The previous year, it had been restored and turned into apartments, and I had rented one on the first floor. Even though it was small, normally someone in my situation would never have been able to afford it, but my material circumstances had changed. Bill Murdoch had died 3 years ago while I was on a brief assignment in Italy. I wasn't invited to the funeral, and that hurt. I just got a note from Grace telling me he had died suddenly and had already been buried. That was my adoptive mother for you, jealous to the end. A few months later, I got a letter from a lawyer saying Bill's matrix of companies, controlled by an offshore trust, had been left to Grace. It wasn't unexpected. They had been married for 40 years. The letter said that, while there was no provision for me, Grace had decided to set aside enough money to provide me with an income of $80,000 a year for life. It didn't spell it out, but the tone was clear. She believed it discharged all her responsibilities towards me. 2 years after the arrangement, almost to the day, Grace herself died. I felt her earlier behavior relieved me of any obligation, and I didn't go back for the huge society funeral at Greenwich's old Episcopalian church. Again, and not for the first time, I was alone in the world. But I couldn't help smiling at what a difference 2 years can make. Had the order of their deaths been reversed, I knew Bill would have made a substantial bequest to me. As it was, Grace left everything to the Metropolitan Museum of Art to rebuild the old master's gallery in her name. This information was conveyed in a letter from the same lawyer who also mentioned that there was a small matter concerning Bill's estate that needed to be finalized. I told him I'd see him at his office in New York when I was home next, and then let it pretty much slip from my mind. The checks from Grace's bequest arrived regularly, and it meant I could live a life far more comfortable than anything the government had ever envisaged with their pension. The most tangible benefit was the apartment in Paris, and I found myself racing through what had once been the mansion's kitchen, converted to a plant room, and flying up a set of fire stairs towards my home. I opened a concealed door next to the elevator and burst into the small foyer. A woman was standing there. It was Madame Danuta Fiore, my 70-year-old neighbor, who lived in the mansion's grandest apartment. The perfectly groomed widow of some aristocratic industrialist, she had the uncanny ability to make everyone else feel like a member of the Third World. She saw my tongue moistening my dry lips, shirt hanging out.
"Something wrong, Mr. Campbell?"
she asked, in her inscrutable upper-class French. She knew me as Peter Campbell, on sabbatical from my job as a hedge fund manager, the only job I knew of which would enable somebody my age to afford to live in the apartment and not work. "Fine, madame. Just worried I left the oven on," I lied. The elevator arrived, she got in, and I unlocked the steel core door into my apartment. Bolting it, not turning on any lights, I sprinted through the living room with its beautiful bay windows and small but growing collection of contemporary art. Bill would have liked that. In the gloom, I ripped open a closet in the dressing room and keyed a code into a small floor safe. Inside was a large amount of cash, a pile of papers, 8 passports in different names, and 3 handguns. I pulled out a 9mm Glock fitted with an extended barrel, the most accurate of them all, checked the action, and grabbed a spare clip. As I slipped it into my waistband, I dwelt on something that had been ricocheting round my head all the way home. If it was the Greeks, how the hell had they found me? One theory I could come up with was that the Russians had stumbled across something and passed it on to their former partners just for old time's sake, you know, and a bucket load of untraceable cash. Or had I made some tiny mistake at Richelieu's that Marcus Boucher had passed on to his clients, and which had allowed them eventually to discover who I was? But, in either case, what had led the Greeks to Paris? For God's sake, I was living under a completely different identity. The knock on the door was firm and definite. I didn't react. I had always known that a hostile would have little difficulty getting into the building. Francois, the middle-aged sniveling concierge, was always leaving the front doors open as he plumbed new depths of servitude. No sooner would he have heard Madame Fure coming down in the elevator than he was probably out in the street alerting the limo driver and fussing around to make sure he was registering ever more clearly on our Christmas gift list. Without hesitation, I did exactly what the training says. I moved fast, silently, into the back of the apartment. One strategy experienced assassins use is to attach a couple of ounces of Semtex, a plastic explosive with the consistency of clay, to the frame of a door before ringing the bell. The perpetrator takes cover, in this case it would be in the elevator car, and detonates it with a call from a cell phone. 8 ounces of Semtex brought down Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, so you can imagine what half that would do to a steel door and anybody looking through a peephole. I backed through the dining room, grabbed a jacket to cover the Glock, and headed for the spare bedroom. When the building had been the Comte de Crissier's mansion, his staff had used a hand-cranked elevator to send meals up from the kitchen to the dining room. This dumbwaiter had terminated in a butler's pantry, which was now my spare bedroom. During the renovation, the shaft had been converted to carry electrical wiring and, under the guise of installing high-speed computer cable to monitor the activities of my non-existent hedge fund, I got permission for a contractor who had installed surveillance equipment on the division's behalf to access the shaft. Having him fit a ladder inside, giving a route to the basement, I figured made the place almost worth the sky-high rent. Right now, it was priceless. I opened a closet door, pulled off an access panel, and in less than a minute was heading into a narrow lane at the back of the building. Any moment I expected to hear the 19th-century facade and the heritage-listed bay windows heading towards a messy landing on the Champs-Élysées. Nothing. What was stopping them? I guess that, having lost me down at the Place de la Madeleine, they had returned immediately to my apartment. Uncertain if I had arrived back yet, the knock on the door was an attempt to find out. Just as well I hadn't answered. I was almost certain there were 2 of them. That's how many I would have used, and they were hiding right now near the elevator, waiting for me to return. That gave me a chance. If I entered by the front doors and took the stairs, I was pretty sure I could surprise them. I was never the best shot in my graduating class, but I was good enough to take them both out. I slowed to a walk as I emerged from the lane, and ran a professional eye over the pedestrians, just to be certain that the guys inside didn't have help on the street. I saw women on their way home from shopping at the luxury stores on Avenue Montaigne, couples walking their dogs, a guy in a Mets cap with his back to me, a tourist by the look of it, window shopping at the patisserie next to my building, but I didn't see anyone who fitted the profile I had in mind. I turned to the vehicles, and equally, there was no white cab or shooter sitting in parked cars that I could see. I moved up close behind a 50-year-old woman in high heels and her boyfriend, 20 years her junior. They wouldn't completely shield me from a sniper on a roof, but they would certainly make the job more difficult. Under cover of them, I steadily closed down the distance to my building. 80 yards. 40. 20. As I passed the patisserie, the guy in the Mets cap spoke to my back.
"Wouldn't it have been easier just to open the fucking door, Mr. Campbell?"
My heart stopped. Every fear I had collapsing into the void that was once my stomach. In the next moment, two distinct and contradictory thoughts fought for primacy. The first was, "So this is how it ends." The retired agent outsmarted on a street in Paris, shot through the head, probably by somebody standing inside the patisserie. Bishaya Mira to me, I guess, bleeding out on the sidewalk, a man I don't even know pocketing the gun as he and the guy in the Mets cap walk away to be picked up by, what else, a white taxi. The other thought was, there's no way they're killing me. Even if there was a shooter on a building or in a room at the Plaza Athénée hotel, the guy in the cap would have signaled silently, and the marksman would have done his job. They don't talk to you in the real world. Only in movies do the bad guys have this pathological need to tell you their life story before they pull the trigger. Out here, there's too much danger, and your mind's way too revved not to just get it over with. Look at Santorini. Nevertheless, there was always a first time, so I still wasn't sure whether to piss myself from fear or from relief. I looked at the man. He was a black guy in his 50s, with a lean body and a handsome face, worn around the edges. More reject China than fine Limoges, I told myself. This assessment was confirmed as he stepped a little closer, and I realized he was limping badly on his right leg.
"I think you called me Mr. Campbell. You're mistaken," I said in French, filling every syllable with my best imitation of Parisian disdain. "My name isn't Campbell."
I was buying time, trying to work out what was going on.
"I guess that's one thing we agree on," he said in English, "given that no Peter Campbell holds a Wall Street trading license, and the hedge fund he manages doesn't exist."
How the hell did he know that? I shifted casually, putting him more squarely between me and the patisserie window.
"So, if you're not Campbell, who are you?"
he went on.
"Jude Garrett, FBI agent and author? Well, that's difficult too, him being dead. Here's another weird thing about Garrett," he said calmly. "I spoke to his cousin down in New Orleans. She was pretty amazed about his literary achievement. She doubted he ever read a book, let alone wrote one."
He knew all this stuff about me, but I was still alive. That was the important point, and he seemed to be missing it. I scanned the rooftops, trying to see if there was a sniper. He watched my eyes, knowing what I was doing, but it didn't affect his swing.
"This is what I figure, Mr. Campbell, or whoever you are. You live under a fake identity, but you wrote the book using a dead man's name just to be safe. I think you worked for the government, and only a handful of people know your real name. Maybe not even that many. To me, that says it's probably not wise to ask what kind of work you did, but the truth is, I don't care. Your book is the best work on investigative technique I have ever read. I just want to talk about it."
I stared at him. Finally, I got it out, speaking in English.
"You want to talk about a book? I was going to kill you."
"Not exactly,"
he said, before lowering his voice.
"Do I call you Mr. Garrett?"
"Campbell," I shot back through clenched teeth. Campbell.
Not exactly, Mr. Campbell. I think if anyone was going to do the killing, it was actually me.
He was right, of course, and, as you'd expect, that made me even more pissed. He put out his hand, unsmiling. I'd learn in time he was a man who hardly ever smiled.
Ben Bradley,
he said calmly.
Homicide Lieutenant, NYPD.
Unsure what else to do, I gripped his hand and we shook. A cop who was learning to walk again, and a pensioned-off covert agent. I know that, on that night, encountering each other for the first time, we both thought that our race was run. Our professional lives had ended, but here's the strange thing. That meeting was of huge significance. It mattered. My God, did it matter. All of it turned out to be important. All of it turned out to be connected in some strange way. The murder at the Eastside Inn, Christos Nikolaidis gunned down in a bar in Santorini, the failed covert operation in Bodrum, my friendship with Ben Bradley, and even a Buddhist monk traveling down a road in Thailand. If I believed in fate, I would have to say there was some hand guiding it all. Very soon, I would learn that one great task still lay ahead of me, one thing which, more than any other, would define my life. Late one afternoon, a short time hence, I would be dragged back into the secret world, and any hope I had of reaching for normal would be gone, probably forever. Like people say, if you want to make God laugh, tell him you've got plans. With precious little information and even less time, I was given the task of finding the one thing which every intelligence agency fears most. A man with no radical affiliations, no entry in any database, and no criminal history. A clean skin. A ghost. I'm afraid that what follows isn't pleasant. If you want to sleep easy in your bed, if you want to look at your kids and think there is a chance they will live in a world better than the one we leave behind, it might be better not to meet him. Part 2. Chapter 1. No matter how many years may pass, even if I should be lucky and grow old in the sun, he will always be the Saracen to me. That was the code name I gave him in the beginning, and I spent so long trying to discover his real identity, it is hard to think of him as anything else. Saracen means Arab, or, in a much older use of the word, a Muslim who fought against the Christians. Go back even further, and you find that it once meant a nomad. All of those things fitted him perfectly. Even today, much of what we know about him is fragmentary. That's not surprising. He spent most of his life running between shadows, deliberately covering his tracks like a Bedouin in the desert. But every life leaves a trace, every ship a wake, and even though it was often just a glimmer of phosphorescence in the dark, we chased them all. It took me through half the souks and mosques of the world, into the secret archives of Arab states and across the desk from dozens of people who might have known him. Later, even after the events of that terrible summer were over, teams of analysts interrogated his mother and sisters for weeks on end, and while I might be accused of putting words into his mouth or thoughts into his head, I make no apology. I ended up knowing more about the Saracen and his family than any man on earth. One thing beyond dispute is that when he was very young, he was swept up in a public beheading. That was in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia's second-largest city, and, by popular agreement, its most sophisticated. Believe me, that's not saying much. Jeddah lies on the shore of the Red Sea, and by the time the Saracen was 14, he was living with his parents and two younger sisters in a modest villa on its outskirts, close enough to the water to smell the salt. We know this because many years later I stood outside the old house and photographed it. Like most Saudis, the boy's father, a zoologist, despised the United States and what the Arab newspaper called its paid-up whore, Israel. His hatred, however, wasn't based on propaganda, the plight of the Palestinians, or even religious bigotry. No, it ran much deeper than that. Over the years, he had listened to both Washington and Tel Aviv, and unlike most Westerners, he believed what our political leaders told him. Their objective was to bring democracy to the Middle East. As a deeply devout Muslim, such a prospect filled him with anger. Being well-educated, at least by local standards, he knew that one of the foundations of democracy was the separation between religion and the state. Yet to many Muslims, the religion is the state. The last thing they want is to separate it. In his opinion, the only reason that infidels would advocate such a thing would be in order to divide and conquer, to hollow out the Arab world and destroy it, pursuing a campaign the Christians had begun with the First Crusade 1,000 years ago and had continued ever since. It would be easy to dismiss the zoologist as an extremist, but in the twilight world of Middle East politics, he was in the moderate wing of Saudi public opinion. There was one thing, however, which did set him apart from the mainstream: his views on the royal family. There are many things you can't do in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Preach about Christianity, attend a movie, drive a car if you're a woman, renounce your faith. But towering above them all is a prohibition on criticizing the House of Saud, the ruling dynasty, made up of the king, 200 powerful princes, and 20,000 family members. All through that year, Jeddah was awash with whispers that the king had allowed American troops, the soldiers of an ungodly country, into the Prophet's sacred land. Equally disturbing was information filtering back from Saudi dissidents in Europe about prominent princes losing fortunes in the casinos of Monte Carlo and showering gold watches on young women from modeling agencies in Paris. Like all Saudis, the zoologist had always known about the gilded palaces and profligate lifestyle of the king. But bad taste and extravagance are not haram, forbidden, in Islam. Prostitution, gambling, and alcohol certainly are. Of course, if you live in Saudi Arabia, you can express your disgust about the policies of the king and the behavior of his family. You can call it an offense against God if you want, and even advocate their forced removal. Just make sure you do it in the safety of your head. To speak to anyone who isn't your wife or father about it, even in the most abstract fashion, is reckless. The Mabahith, the Saudi secret police, a law unto itself, and its network of informers hear everything, know everything. It was late on a spring day when four of its agents, all wearing the white tunics called thobes and the usual red and white check headdress, visited the zoologist at work. They showed their identity cards and led him out of his office, through an area of laboratories and workstations, and into the car park. The 20 other people working in that section of the Red Sea Marine Biology Department watched the door slam behind him, nobody saying a word, not even his three closest friends, one of whom was almost certainly the informer. We will never know exactly what the zoologist was accused of, or what defense he offered, because Saudi judicial proceedings, conducted in secret, aren't concerned with time-consuming niceties like witnesses, lawyers, juries, or even evidence. The system relies entirely on signed confessions obtained by the police. It's strange how methods of torture are one of the few things which cross all racial, religious, and cultural boundaries. Poor militia in Rwanda, who worship ghosts, use pretty much the same methods as rich Catholics supervising state security in Colombia. As a result, the Muslim cops who took the zoologist into a cell in a Jeddah prison had nothing new to offer. Just a heavy-duty truck battery with special clips for the genitals and nipples. The first the zoologist's family knew of the catastrophe engulfing them was when he failed to arrive home from work. After evening prayers, they made a series of phone calls to his colleagues, which either went unanswered or were met by contrived ignorance. From grim experience, people knew that those listening in would target anyone trying to help a criminal's family. Increasingly desperate, the zoologist's wife finally agreed to her 14-year-old son heading out to try to find him. She couldn't do it herself because Saudi law forbids a woman to be in public unless she is accompanied by her brother, father, or husband. The teenager left his mother and two sisters and set off on his dirt bike, a gift for his last birthday from his dad. Keeping to the back streets, he drove fast to a group of seaside office blocks, where he found his father's car alone in the parking lot. Only in a police state does a child pray for nothing more serious than a crippling accident to have befallen their parent. Beseeching Allah that the zoologist was lying injured in the darkened building that housed his office, the boy approached the entrance. A Pakistani security guard stationed in an alcove in the gloomy interior was startled when he saw a boy's face peering through the glass doors. Yelling in bad Arabic, he motioned the kid away, grabbing a billy club, ready to unlock the doors and use it if he had to. But the boy didn't flinch. Calling back desperately in Arabic, imploring the help of the prophet, saying something about a missing father. It was only then that the guard realized the visit was connected to the event that had caused a tidal wave of whispered gossip all afternoon. He stared at the child's drowning face. He was far too young to be clinging to such tiny hopes, and lowered the club. Maybe it was because he had kids of his own, but the tectonic plates of the guard's universe shifted, and he did something totally out of character. He took a chance. With his back turned to the security cameras monitoring the doors, gesticulating as if shooing him away, he told the boy what little he knew. Four members of the state police, led by a colonel, had taken his father away in handcuffs. According to their driver, a fellow Pakistani to whom he'd taken a cup of tea, they had been secretly investigating the man for months. But listen close, he said. This was the important part. They were talking about charging him with corruption on Earth, a term so broad as to be meaningless, except for one thing. It carried the death sentence.
Tell your family, the Pakistani continued. They'll have to act fast if they're going to save him.
With that, he threw the doors open as if he'd lost patience and, for the benefit of the cameras, started swinging his billy club with a wild vengeance. The boy ran for the dirt bike and kicked it to life. Caring nothing for himself, he sped across the parking lot, nearly lost it in a drift of sand, and flew through the gates. Though no one will ever know for sure, I imagine that, mentally, he was being torn in two. As a child, he desperately wanted the comfort of his mother, but as a man, the head of the household in his father's absence, he needed the counsel of other men. There was only one way this conflict could be resolved. He was an Arab, and that meant 2,000 years of baggage about male pride. So it was inevitable that he would turn north, into the darkest part of the city, towards the house of his grandfather. Even as he drove, a sense of informed doom started to grow upon him. He knew his father was as good as locked in a cattle car being driven by state security, and he realized it would take a huge amount of wasta to alter the course of that journey. In the absence of democracy and efficient bureaucracies, wasta is the way the Arab world works. It means connections, influence, a web of old favors and tribal history. With wasta, doors, even to palaces, open. Without it, they remain forever closed. The boy had never thought about it before, but he saw now that his family, including his grandfather, whom he loved so dearly, were modest people. Modest in ambition, modest in their connections. For them to influence state security and have what was considered an attack on the House of Saud dismissed would be, well, it would be like taking a knife to a nuclear war. By the end of the night, after the long and closed councils of his uncles, grandfather, and cousins had failed to initiate one significant phone call, he knew he was right about their chances. But that didn't mean that any of them gave up. For 5 months, the family, close to collapse under the stress, tried to penetrate the Saudi gulag and find one tiny life hidden in its labyrinth. And what did they get for their trouble? No information, no assistance from their government, and certainly no contact with the zoologist. Like the victims of 9/11, he had just gone to work one morning and never returned. The man was lost in a surreal maze, trapped among the living dead in hundreds of crowded cells. It was here he quickly learned that everybody ends up signing a confession, a testament to the 12-volt lead-acid battery, but that among the inmates there were two distinct groups. The first surrendered themselves to their fate, or Allah, and just scrawled their name on the damn thing. The second group figured their only hope was to sign the document in order finally to get before a judge. They could then recant their confession and proclaim their innocence. This was the strategy the zoologist adopted. The Saudi judicial system, however, has developed a way of dealing with this. The prisoner is simply returned to the police to explain his change of mind. It's far too depressing to go into the enhanced methods used against these men and women. Suffice to say, nobody has ever gone before a judge and recanted their confession a second time. Never. Having at last admitted and been convicted of seditious statements and corruption on Earth, the zoologist's journey through the system ground to a sudden halt. The cause was traffic problems in downtown Jeddah. At least 10 days' notice was needed to close the huge car park outside the main mosque. Only then could the white marble platform be erected in its center. Chapter 2. Spectators started gathering early in the morning, as soon as they saw the barricades going up and the special team of carpenters erecting the platform. Public announcements about impending executions are rare in the kingdom, but by cell phone and text message, the word always spreads. Within hours, large crowds were streaming into the car park, and by the time a 12-year-old boy, the Saracen's best friend, drove past with his father, he knew exactly what it meant. It was a Friday, the Muslim day of rest, and the traffic was terrible, so it took the kid over an hour to get home. He immediately grabbed his bicycle and rode 8 miles to tell his friend what he had seen. Fearing the worst, mentioning nothing to his mother or sisters, the Saracen got on his dirt bike, piled his friend on board, and headed for the Corniche, the road that runs beside the Red Sea into downtown Jeddah. Just as the boys caught sight of the sea, noon prayers had finished at the main mosque, and hundreds of men were spilling out to join masses of spectators waiting in the parking lot. In the harsh summer light, the men in their stark white thobes made a stunning contrast to the knots of women in their black abayas and face veils. Only little kids in jeans and shirts added a splash of color. Executions are about the only form of public entertainment permitted in Saudi Arabia. Movies, concerts, dancing, plays, and even mixed-sex coffee shops are banned. But everybody's welcome, women and kids too, to see someone lose their life. Eschewing such modern innovations as medical injections or even the firing squad, the Saudi method seems to be a real crowd-pleaser. Public beheading. It was close to 110 degrees on the Corniche that day, the heat bouncing off the asphalt in shimmering waves as the dirt bike threaded rapidly through the weekend traffic. Up ahead, chaos was unfolding. The road was being torn up for a new overpass. Construction machinery blocked all but one lane, and cars were tailed back for blocks. Inside his sweltering helmet, the zoologist's son was also in chaos. Frightened, almost to vomiting, desperately hoping it was an African drug dealer being taken to the platform. He couldn't afford to think that, if he was wrong, the last he would see of his father would be him kneeling on the marble, the flies already buzzing, the silver sword disappearing in a fountain of red. He looked at the impenetrable traffic ahead and swung the dirt bike off the shoulder and, in a whirl of dust and debris, blasted into the badly cratered construction site. Despite the size of the crowd gathering for the display, there was little noise in the parking lot. Just the murmur of voices and the sound of a mullah reading from the Quran over the mosque's public address system. Gradually, even the quiet voices fell silent as an official car made its way through the cordon and stopped at the platform. A powerfully built man in an immaculate white thobe got out of the vehicle and mounted the 5 steps to the platform. A polished leather strap ran diagonally across his chest and terminated on his left hip, supporting a scabbard which held a long, curved sword. This was the executioner. His name was Saeed bin Abdullah bin Mabruk al-Bishi, and he was acknowledged as the best craftsman in the kingdom. His reputation built primarily on a procedure called a cross amputation. Far more difficult than a simple beheading and meted out as punishment for highway robbery, it requires the rapid use of custom-made knives to cut off a prisoner's right hand and left foot. By applying himself diligently to this process, Saeed al-Bishi had over many years steadily raised the overall standard of Saudi Arabia's public punishments. Only occasionally now did the public see an executioner having to keep hacking at a prisoner's head or limbs to detach them from his body. Returning greetings from several onlookers, Albishi had barely had time to familiarize himself with his workspace when he saw a white van push through the crowd. A policeman lifted a barrier, and the air-conditioned vehicle stopped next to the steps. The crowd craned forward to catch sight of the occupant as the rear doors opened. The zoologist stepped out of the van into the cauldron barefoot, blindfolded by a thick white bandage, his wrists handcuffed behind his back. Among those watching were people who knew him, or thought they did, and it took a moment for them to recognize his features. God knows what the secret police had done to him in the previous 5 months, but he seemed to have shrunk. He was a shell of a man, broken and diminished at least in his body, like those translucent old people you sometimes see in retirement homes. He was 38 years old. He knew exactly where he was and what was happening. An official of the so-called Ministry of Justice had arrived at his cell 40 minutes earlier and had read him a formal decree. It was the first he knew that he had been sentenced to death. As two uniformed cops led him slowly to the steps of the platform, witnesses said he raised his face to the sun and tried to straighten his shoulders. I'm sure he didn't want his son and daughters to hear that their father didn't have courage. On the corniche, gridlock drivers watched with a mixture of disgust and envy as the dirt bike blasted past, using the construction site as a private freeway. Damn kids. The young boy slid the bike past coiled fire hoses used to spray the overworked Bangladeshi construction workers and prevent them passing out from heat exhaustion, then weaved through a forest of concrete pylons. He had about 7 minutes to reach the square. I don't think, even later in life, he could have explained why he undertook that wild ride. What was he going to do there? My own belief is that, in his fear and anguish, all he could think of was that he was of his father's soul as much as his body, and such a bond would accept nothing less than his presence. He swung the bike hard left, through a wasteland of piled debris, and flew even faster towards a road that fed into the square. It was blocked by a chain-link fence, but on the other side of bundles of steel-reinforcing rods, he saw an opening just wide enough to squeeze through. Allah was with him. He slid the bike even tighter left, slaloming through the bundles of rods, sending up clouds of fine dust, closing fast on the narrow gap. He was going to make it. The zoologist, blinded on the platform, felt a hand fall on his neck and press him down. It belonged to the executioner, and he was being told to kneel. As he lowered himself, the feeling of the sun on his face indicated that he was facing Mecca, 40 miles away. Directly in its path was his house, and the thought of his wife and children sitting in its loving confines sent a shudder of loss through his body. The executioner gripped the man's shoulder. The swordsman had been here many times before, and he knew the exact moment when a man might need steadying. A voice called out a command on the mosque's public address system. All across the square, stretching from the austere Ministry of Foreign Affairs building to the grass in front of the mosque, thousands of people knelt to face Mecca in prayer. As with all devout Muslims, the zoologist knew the words by heart, and he spoke them in unison with the crowd. He also knew their exact length. By any reasonable estimate, he had 4 minutes left on earth. The boy, half-blinded by the dust kicked up by his swerving bike, didn't see one bundle of the steel-reinforcing rods until a second too late. Protruding at least a foot from the others, one of the rods was already sliding between the spokes of his front wheel when he first registered it. His reaction time was incredible. He hurled the bike to the side, but not quite fast enough. With the front wheel spinning, the rod tore the spokes apart in a fury of ripping metal. Chunks of thin alloy ripped through the bike's gas tank and cylinder head. The wheel collapsed, the front forks dug into the dirt, and the bike stopped instantly. The zoologist's son and his friend kept going, straight over the handlebars and landing in a tangle of flying limbs and spraying dirt. Badly stunned, the dirt bike fit only for the scrap heap. They were barely conscious. By the time the first of the shocked motorists watching from the corniche had reached them, the prayers in the parking lot had finished, and the crowd was rising. The executioner stepped close to the kneeling prisoner, and the whole square fell silent. The swordsman made a slight adjustment to the angle of the zoologist's neck, and those spectators